Welcome to Indie Radio News. It's a new weekly radio news program of The Independent, a free New York City-based newspaper and website with a monthly print of over 45,000 copies distributed all over the city. We cover social justice movements and the issues they are fighting for both here in New York and around the world. We are your hosts, Elia Grand and Lydia McMullen-Laird.
Beginning with headlines. In Indonesia, rescuers are struggling to reach victims in several large coastal towns that were hit by an earthquake and tsunami Friday evening. The confirmed death toll of 844 is expected to rise. This as authorities reach areas that were cut off by the disaster. Officials are burying hundreds of dead in a mass grave. Thousands of survivors are trying to leave. They say there is little food and that their homes are unsafe. And in national news, well, last night, Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren said she'd take a hard look at a presidential run, Arizona's Republican Senator Jeff Flake also raised speculation. Flake emerged as a central figure in the explosive debate over Donald Trump's Supreme Court pick Brett Kavanaugh. Flake is scheduled to speak in New Hampshire this evening. It will be his second appearance in the state this year, which hosts the nation's first presidential primary election. On Friday, Flake single-handedly delayed Kavanaugh's confirmation proceedings by insisting on an FBI investigation. This after he was confronted in an elevator by two women who are sexual assault survivors, which led him to say he would vote for the nomination to go before the full Senate vote if the FBI investigated allegations against Kavanaugh. Donald Trump today said it's fine with him if the FBI wants to pursue accusations made by three of the women who came forward publicly. He said, "My White House will do whatever the senators want. The one thing I want is speed." He added, "We don't want to go on a witch hunt, do we?" The Trump administration is receiving criticism over the limited scope of the investigation, which includes interviews with just four people, Mark Judge and PJ Smythe, high school friends of Judge Kavanaugh's, Leland Kaiser, a high school friend of Dr. Blasey, and Deborah Ramirez, another of Kavanaugh's accusers. Meanwhile, a person close to Dr. Blasey says the FBI has not yet scheduled an interview with her. Turning to NAFTA, Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland says the new free trade deal with the United States and Mexico is a victory for Canadians. Freeland was Canada's chief negotiator in the talks. She says the deal maintains tariff-free access to the majority of Canadian exports to the American market. The U.S. market accounts for 75% of what Canada exports, so the deal is critical for Canada. The agreement was reached late Sunday, which gives U.S. farmers greater access to the Canadian dairy market. In immigration news, hundreds of migrant children have been moved to a tent city in West Texas. According to the New York Times, the children were loaded onto buses in the middle of the night and moved across the country. Until now, most migrant children held by the federal government were kept in foster homes or shelters. The move to a tent city comes as the federal government struggles to find room for over 13,000 migrant children. And two researchers won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for their groundbreaking work on immunotherapy today. James Allison of the University of Texas and Tasuku Honjo of Kyoto University won their award for discovering how to stimulate the body's immune system to attack tumors. Allison's drug, known commercially as Yervoy, became the first to extend the survival of patients with late-stage melanoma. He says, "We need these drugs to work for more people." He added, "It's a great emotional privilege to meet cancer patients who've been successfully treated with immune checkpoint blockade. They are living proof of the power of basic science."
And welcome to Indie Radio News. Today we have a very special program. We will be talking about Sunday's rally, the March for Black Women. We will talk about the climate and about New York's Climate Week. And we will also have a direct connection with Lydia, who is going out to the rally in downtown Manhattan against Kavanaugh's nomination. Let's start off this program with the rally that happened Sunday. And Sunday, Black women and their allies rallied in Park Row near City Hall in a call to action demanding full reauthorization of the Violence Against Women's Act, or VAWA, V-A-W-A, which was set to expire on Sunday, the same day, on September 13th. This march was led by Black Women's Blueprint, and it crossed over the Brooklyn Bridge into a park where a vigil took place to honor Black women and girls who have been impacted by violence and sexual assault as the activists counted down the minutes until VAWA was set to expire.
Yeah, I'm a My name is Jackie Brown. We're at a moment when we're recognizing the pervasiveness of sexual violence against women, and Black women have experienced sexual violence since Africans got here. So it's especially important for us to come out here and voice our anger at the perpetuity of this kind of, or the perpetuation of violence against women, and especially Black women, but all women, really.
The Violence Against Women Act, which was one of the big themes of yesterday's rally, has been renewed until 2018, December. This act was enacted in 1994, and it was put in place in part to fund social services against agencies that support to fund social services for agencies that support victims of sexual assault and domestic violence. This law was created after the hearing in 1992 of Anita Hill. Let's listen to more of the participants in yesterday's rally.
This is very important. I mean, we saw this, we've been dealing with this in public since at least the Anita Hill hearings, and now it's just another iteration of it. And it's an important moment also because we get to see how sympathetically people see the white survivor of sexual violence, as opposed to Anita Hill, who was not seen quite so sympathetically by the American public. So, I mean, I support Dr. Ford with every ounce of my being, but we have to realize also, why is it that she's seen as so sympathetic and Anita Hill was not? But no matter what, I'm just very happy that we have a moment where women are really speaking out, and the Latina sister who confronted the senator in the elevator, she's a hero, you know, and we just have to keep our voices out there and keep fighting. This is a wonderful moment. This is a very important and wonderful moment.
The liberation of all women started with a Black woman speaking up, saying enough is enough. We're not going to let this guy go in here after all the horrible things that he's done. We do matter. Our voice does matter. You're not just going to take our bodies and use us and then dispose of us. We should be protected, that when we speak, that you hear us, that you listen, that you invite us, that you have a place for us at the table. That intersectionality needs to happen more now than ever. Because it's getting to a point where the people are beginning to see all the trauma and the things that have happened over the years. Things are being uncovered, even within government, within the food that we eat, within how we live, all the things that corporations and that, you know, the man, the top 1% has done, these structures that have been put in place, they're now being uncovered. So the time is now. There's no other time than right now. At this point, at this moment, this place here, this is it.
I'm 9. I came out to march with my sign. It says every great dream begins with a dreamer. And it's a quote from Harriet Tubman. It means that sort of you can believe in whatever you want to believe in, and it will come true if you believe it.
My name is Natalie Matos, and I'm with the International Women's Strike, the New York City branch. So International Women's Strike endorsed the March for Black Women, not just because they've been receiving a lot of obstacles and had a lot of limitations getting started in the beginning after being sort of censored, but just because the numbers are staggering of the violence towards Black women specifically, and obviously as an organization that stands as an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, feminist, for women of color, it's very vital to kind of support and be allowed to lift the voices of the organizations that are doing the work from the grassroots level, from experience, and seeing that we've worked with Black Women's Blueprint and the Hudson Valley Black Women's March. It felt like the absolute right thing to do, and especially as times are getting darker, you know, seemingly, it's great to see a space where we can not only lift these voices but celebrate the work and the surviving. Me Too has a tendency of being able to become a liberal conversation, as generally speaking, women have the same issues, you know, of sexual assault, abuse, and violence. But there's a particular vulnerability that exists in, like, Black spaces, immigrant spaces, undocumented, Muslim. The most marginalized women often have it, obviously not just, like, the worst, but the most painful and most silenced. So there's a particular importance to this movement that you can't really replicate in other spaces in New York City, I would say.
And in Indie Radio News, we got a chance to talk to Farah Tennis, who is the co-founder and executive director of Black Women's Blueprint, who led and organized the march together with other organizations. Farah, we asked Farah to explain to us how, as a Black woman, the term survivor, what that means to her.
Our history is ever present in our everyday lives. We, because of racism. And for Black women, the story of racism also includes racialized rape, racialized forced breeding of Black women on plantations and in the big houses, racialized rape when our husbands or our brothers were being lynched, or racialized rape before we were lynched. There is a cyclical relationship as well between poverty and sexual abuse. So when someone is more poor, like my mother, we understand what these structures mean. If Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed, we know that we thought that there was a war on women. There will be an even more virulent war on women. And those of us who are Black women, those of us who are Native American women, those of us who are immigrant women and trans-identified women will be impacted the most. And so when we talk about violence against women, we're talking about, you know, not just the rape that we suffer inside of our homes or on a date or on the campus or at the hands of our families or folks that we know. As you know, in 80 to 90% of the cases, it's someone we know these days, right? This is very different from how it was with Black women during the Jim Crow era, right? We talked a lot about how white men would kidnap Black women like Recy Taylor and rape them. And then just send them back home. We talked a lot about that. But now we are dealing with this inside our communities.
Well, many people, thank you, Farah. Many people are drawing comparisons between Dr. Ford's testimony and Anita Hill's 1991. At the same time, there's obvious differences that that come from, like, the actual context and the way people are seeing Dr. Ford's testimony. Can you talk to us a little bit about those differences in both of those cases?
As young women, as children, we learned a very valuable lesson, and it's that as a Black woman, you keep your mouth shut. Whoever it is who has committed an act of sexual violence against you, whether it's sexual harassment or anything else, you keep your mouth shut. And we've been speaking about this as Black women. We just remember feeling so ashamed to be women, to be Black women. And I think that's the difference, right, between today and what happened back in 1991 with Anita Hill, is that this sense of shame that survivors and that women felt, Black women in particular, we were forced to feel, that was heaved upon us, it's not being felt today. People are saying, I am Christine Ford, whereas you did not want to be Anita Hill back in the 90s. That is the woman you wanted to avoid being like. You did not want to act like her. You did not want to betray your race like her. You did not want to drag a Black man down like her. You did not want to be tried, you know, by the population and in the courts by her, and that no matter what you did, it would not be believed. And you do not want to be a traitor like her. And so that is the difference. We didn't have the protests that we have now. What happened during the Anita Hill days is that Black feminists took out that one-page ad, right, in the New York Times in order, paying for it, in order to show support for Anita Hill, to say, I believe Anita Hill. And I believe that our parents and our grandparents owe Anita Hill an apology for having vilified her. And I'm talking about Black folks, and for having used her as the example of what shame looks like, because the shame was not hers. The shame was on us. The shame was on our community. The shame was on our country, and it was not hers.
Thank you so much for tennis. She is the co-founder and executive director of Black Women's Blueprint, one of the main organizers of Sunday's March for Black Women. When we come back, we will talk to environmentalist Casey Harrell about BlackRock and their investment in fossil fuels. Last Wednesday, environmentalists launched a campaign to pressure the trillion-dollar asset management BlackRock to divest from fossil fuels. Since the 2008 financial crash, asset managers like BlackRock have gained control of $90 trillion in global capital, investing in heavily in oil, gas, and coal. Lucas Ross, senior policy analyst at Friends of the Earth, spoke with The Independent in Midtown while reaching out to BlackRock employees on their lunch break. You can hear his clip on what he said about BlackRock in front of their headquarters in Midtown last Wednesday when the environmentalists were doing an action.
BlackRock is a $6.3 trillion behemoth. It is the largest investor on the planet. Any movement that it made out of any sector, fossil fuels included, would have massive global reverberations. If BlackRock were to get out of fossil fuels, it would have incredible implications for, you know, the ultimate goal right now, which is keeping fossil fuels in the ground. Right now, BlackRock is an ivy right into the arm of the climate crisis. It needs to take steps to stop being part of the problem.
BlackRock is now the world's biggest investor, but it's got a big problem. That's one of the mottos that the environmentalists were saying last Wednesday while they were giving away free granola bars with wrappings where it's had messages for the people who are going inside the BlackRock headquarters. To talk more about this action and about BlackRock, we talked to Casey Harrell from the Sunrise Project. Casey, are you with us?
I'm here.
Thank you, Casey. Casey works in the Australian-based organization Sunrise Project that has launched a campaign to encourage BlackRock to divest from fossil fuel holdings. Casey also carries 2 decades of experience directing successful international climate and corporate accountability campaigns for groups ranging like Greenpeace International to Forest Ethics. And he has helped to start the anti-sweatshop movement in the U.S. in the 90s and a few more achievements. Congratulations, Casey, for such extensive work in environmentalism. I guess I would want to ask you a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about this campaign that Sunrise Project is aiming for, and why BlackRock?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we know right now, to be able to give our society any chance in tackling climate change, we've got to follow the money. We've got to shift finance as quickly as possible. And so there's a lot of different players in the finance sector, but none bigger than BlackRock. As we heard from Lucas in the previous clip, it's the world's largest investor. It's the biggest asset manager on the planet. It has $6.3 trillion. If you looked at the 20 largest pension funds in the world, BlackRock has more money than all of them combined. And so if there's any way that we can move the world's largest asset manager to shift their capital out of fossil fuels and into the climate solutions that we need, we're going to have a huge knock-on impact within the rest of the financial sector.
And I wanted to ask you, because the Independent, which published an article about last Wednesday's action, they contacted Brian Bittis, one of the spokespersons for BlackRock. And I want to quote, Brian said, BlackRock has invested more in renewable power projects than virtually any other asset manager in the world, and also is the largest provider of sustainable ETFs, including the industry's largest low-carbon ETF. What can you say about that, Casey?
Well, I mean, it's a great talking point for us, actually. You know, it's kind of funny. You know, what BlackRock's going to say, and they sort of hinted at it here, is that they're the biggest because they're the biggest. And what I mean by that is that they're going to say, well, we're the biggest investor in new coal plants around the world. We're the biggest investor in oil and gas. It's because we're the biggest. And then similarly, they're going to say, we're the biggest or one of the biggest investors in renewable energy projects in terms of asset management. You know, BlackRock's not a bank per se, so they're not investing in project level financing, but they're investing in corporate level finance to a whole host of projects. And it's true, they do invest in renewable energy, and that's fantastic. Broken clocks right twice a day. You know what I mean? And so it's one of those things where, and again, they are a big provider of what, you know, what he's referring to as ETFs, exchange traded funds. Mm-hmm. They're very similar to mutual funds. And, you know, they do have sustainably screened funds that they offer to clients who ask for them. And that's the key piece here. We cannot go investor by investor and say, hey, can we change your mind? And can we get you to go talk to your asset manager and demand cleaner screened investments? We need to go. We don't have time in terms of being able to tackle climate change to have a niche approach where a set of boutique investors who want to proactively contact a BlackRock, a Vanguard, a State Street, a Fidelity, and say, hey, please change your investments for me because I want you to change. Right. And so, you know, that's the big key. When you look at the number, the percentage of ETFs, the percentage of assets that BlackRock has that are screened out for fossil fuel companies, it's way less than 1%. So we're talking about a niche when we really need to be talking about a replacement in terms of shifting massive amounts of capital that BlackRock holds in these various funds, not providing, you know, it's not about selling a whole, you know, six lines of Hummers and then offering a Prius or a Tesla. We need to radically shift and change over what these asset managers are offering to their customers.
Well, it's sort of that leads into my last question because we're running a little bit tight on time today. But this action took place in the frame of the climate week in New York City, which there's a certain hypocrisy is sort of what I'm reading from your words of how much one does in comparison to how much one could do. Could you tell us a little bit about climate week and sort of what it really means and how it comes off on activists and the roles that the company should be playing?
Yeah, I mean, so last week was Climate Week, and it's a big week. It happens at the end of September every year in New York. It's one of the reasons why traffic was so terrible in Midtown last week. And so, you know, what it does is it brings in a lot of heads of state, you know, who are in for the UNGA as well, and then it brings in a number of companies. And really, the bar is so low right now that it's almost like a blank canvas. So you have companies coming in and saying, hey, look, this is what we're doing around climate. And there's so much action that needs to be taking place. You know, some people have asked us, well, is this pure greenwash? Is this like the equivalent of oil companies coming in and saying drilling for more oil is really green and it's great? It's not that type of greenwash. In fact, some of the things that the companies go to Climate Week and talk about are okay. But in terms of the scope of the problem and the type of work that needs to happen to meet the level of ambition that we need to sort of have, Climate Week and these sort of corporate commitments are falling way short. BlackRock's a great example. They made an announcement last week with a number of different foundations in a couple of different countries to talk about opening up a line of capital that would allow specifically in Southeast Asia low to no carbon credit. So essentially, as Southeast Asia builds out its energy infrastructure, that, you know, they need more access to low carbon capital so that they don't build coal plants, they build renewable energy instead. That's not a bad thing.
Right.
Now, there's no details. And again, this is literally an announcement that says, we plan to work on this.
Right.
Get back to us next year about how it works. But in the same sense, it's one of those things where it's like, look, where's the most impactful way that these companies can be making change? And when you look at, it's not just about the solution side, it's about pulling the capital. It's a divest and reinvest, right? And so it's not just, you know, it's not an all of the above type strategy in terms of investment. It's actually shutting down capital investments.
Well, thank you so much, Casey. And We wish we had more time to talk to you. We will definitely tune into the projects that Sunrise Projects is working on and keep a good eye on Black Rock. Thank you. Now for the last part of our show, we will be going live to downtown Manhattan where Lydia McMullen-Lair, our co-host, is live in a rally against Kavanaugh. Lydia, can you hear us?
Yes. Hi, Elia. I'm here near the Flatiron Building in downtown Manhattan where survivors of sexual assault and their allies are protesting Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. The energy is building here as people are getting ready to march to the Yale Club of New York City. People are holding signs like, Kavan, no, not now, not ever. And even very personal signs like, my rapist was also a blackout drunk. Don't put one on the Supreme Court. So for a lot of the people attending here, this is a very personal story. And this is just one of the many actions that have taken place across the country over the past week as people are becoming increasingly outraged that Judge Kavanaugh's nomination proceedings are moving forward despite accusations from sexual assault victims and multiple women.
How many people would you say
and there are
is there?
Hundreds of people here.
Okay.
There are hundreds of people here packed in between Broadway and Fifth. And I'm here with Annie, who is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. Annie, why is it important for you to be here today?
It's important because after my sexual assault, I felt really small and like my voice didn't matter. And it's kind of intimidating to be out in the streets in public, but it feels empowering to like come out here and be angry and to embrace my physical presence in the space.
And what are you calling for? What are you and other people here at this rally calling for?
Well, there's the basic request of or demand that Kavanaugh not be appointed to the Supreme Court. But I think it's also a larger conversation about the way that survivors are treated and the systems that we have in place. We, you know, don't take people's stories seriously, and we, you know, as a society, don't confront the reasons behind it. And so it's a broader conversation that's important to us.
And Annie, what else do you want our listeners to know just about, you know, your story and what it feels like to be in your position at this time in history?
Well, I think what's really important is that we saw the testimony of Dr. Ford is that not everything is super black and white when it comes to sexual assault. And for someone like me that had a experience that was very much in the gray area, it's hard to feel validated when we only have one narrative about what sexual assault looks like, unfortunately. And so I think the biggest thing is to realize that there's nuances within the experiences of survivors and that all of them are valid and all of them are painful and all of them are traumatic.
Thank you so much, Annie. And over here, we have Renee Parisi. She's an organizer for the Democratic Socialists of America. Renee, can you tell us a little bit more about the impact you think these types of actions have on the national dialogue around sexual assault?
I mean, I think that what you've seen is that even people who recognized Kavanaugh as being a disaster for women's rights, for workers' rights, for all the kinds of things that GSA cares about, that the hearing on Thursday was just such a spectacle of a woman who we all believed and a man responding with anger and disbelief that anyone would challenge his elite power. And so I think why we're out here is trying to send the message to the Senate, to the people in power, that we're not going to take this anymore, that you cannot put a sexual assaulter on the court. And I think that what you've seen, the power of protest, is that this has moved the dialogue, particularly in D.C. We wanted to put on something in New York so folks who couldn't make it down there could share their experience, share their rage, share their stories, get out there and show that they might want a sexual assaulter on the court.
And as an organizer, what are you calling for and what do you feel about this FBI investigation? Is it enough?
I mean, I would never trust the FBI to help out the left. But I think that what the investigation does is it gives us another week to show our strength, to show up in the streets, to show up in our senators' offices, and to say no.
Thank you so much, Renee. And back to you, Elia.
Lydia, and I just wanted to ask you, are you guys marching or are you going to the Yale Club, right?
Yeah, so everyone's gathering here. They're getting their signs ready. There's even some signs that are flashing so that it'll be visible once it goes dark. And then everybody
wow, with lights, like
gonna,
LED lights.
Yeah, like lights on the signs so that people will be able to see these messages visibly as the sun is going to start to go down during the march. And everyone is going to be marching to the Yale Club of New York City, which is, of course, where Kavanaugh went to college. So there's a symbolic
wow.
action to where this march is ending up. And there's a lot of energy here. There's a lot of people, you know, supporting sexual assault survivors and a lot of survivors themselves coming out to kind of stand up
and make their voices heard on this issue.
Excellent. Just one last question. Are there any other organizations that have showed up? I think the Women's Strike organization is also there.
Yeah, the Women's Strike is here. The Democratic Socialists of America are here. There's actually lots of organizations that have come together to sort of support women's issues and to weigh in on this.
All right. Thank
you. And
then
there's lots of people just coming in, you know, from just on their own independently.
Thank you so much, Lydia. We're going to have to leave you at there. And obviously, any of our listeners who want to join Lydia, just go to Flatiron. And, well, thank you for listening to another Indie Radio Newscast. You can catch us every Monday at 6 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5. For the latest Indie Radio news. We are a weekly radio show that comes from The Independent, a monthly print edition of The Independent. You can find it at any outdoor news boxes, libraries, social centers, independent bookstores, social movements. You can also follow our coverage of The Independent at independent.org. That's IndyPendent.org and via social media. Feel free to reach us at 212-904-1282 or at contact@independent.org. Thank you so much, WBI, and thank you for joining us. I am Elia Grand, and my co-host who is out on the field today is Lydia McMullen-Laird. Thank you for listening to Indie Radio News.